Hi friends, welcome to Spilling the Beans podcast, where we spill the beans on all things intuitive eating, health at every size, body acceptance, and gentle nutrition. I'm your host and registered dietitian, Amanda Lambrix, and you may know me as @spillingthebeans_nutrition on Instagram and Facebook. Go ahead, get comfortable, grab a snack, and let's get started spilling the beans. Today we have our first guest, Mackenzie Caldwell, on to discuss the third principle of intuitive eating, make peace with food. Mackenzie is a registered dietitian and owner of the Charlotte, North Carolina-based private practice Feed Your Zest Nutrition and Wellness, where she specializes in nutrition therapy for hypothalamic amenorrhea, pregnancy, diabetes, and eating disorders using a weight-inclusive approach. She empowers her clients to look beyond food as they move towards thriving through intuitive eating. I also wanted to make note that when we recorded this episode, her Instagram handle was @feedyourzest, but since then it has been changed to @womens.health.dietitian. So make sure to give Mackenzie a follow on that account. In this episode, we discuss her experience learning about health at every size and intuitive eating, how she uses the principles to empower women, what a peaceful relationship with food looks like, why unconditional permission to eat can be so intimidating, and so much more. I really think you're going to enjoy this episode, and of course, it will also be fantastic to hear more than just my voice this week. Enjoy! Hi, welcome back to the podcast. Today, as I mentioned in our intro, we have Mackenzie Caldwell, and I'm so excited to have her here today.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going awesome. And honestly, with all this social distancing right now, it feels even better to have guests on the podcast where I can kind of take advantage of that as like a happy hour almost.
Yeah, I bet.
Absolutely. So for listeners who don't already follow you on social media or have seen you other places in the dietetics world, can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a registered dietitian. I'm based in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I have a private practice here where I see clients in person and virtually, and I specialize in eating disorders and then female reproductive health issues like pregnancy, hypothalamic amenorrhea, gestational diabetes, and then diabetes in general, and then kind of those folks who would like to work on their relationship with food, may not have a clinically diagnosed eating disorder, but want to pursue intuitive eating and just a better relationship with food overall.
I find it so interesting. I knew that you were specializing more in like the women's health and know a lot about hormones and all of that. And how long have you been a dietitian now?
I have been a dietitian for 1 year and 3 months.
And the reason I ask is because when I was first a dietitian, I don't think I knew half of those things that you just mentioned and definitely didn't specialize in them. So to me, I'm sitting here like, wow, that's so impressive. What internship did you go to?
Thanks. Yeah, I did the Chapel Hill, the UNC Chapel Hill MPH RD program. I did my undergrad at Cornell in nutrition. And then it was kind of like, I don't want to say it was a repeat of everything I learned in undergrad, but it kind of helped me really dive deeper into like biochem of nutrition and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I figured out I liked diabetes. I thought diabetes was kind of boring before grad school. And then once I kind of learned a little bit more of the biochem behind it and how you can do it in practice in the internship, I got more interested in that. And then I wrote my master's paper on gestational diabetes and kind of just took a special interest in pregnancy overall and kind of tried to tailor some of my grad school courses around that and do continuing ed in that area too. And then like with hypothalamic amenorrhea, just kind of working in the eating disorder field, that's kind of something that comes up a lot. It's definitely like, it sounds really scary, but a lot of it is really a lot less scary than people think, even on the dietitian end. The nutrition therapy for hypothalamic amenorrhea isn't as foreboding as one might think. And a lot of the same principles you might use when you're helping somebody heal their relationship with food or recover from an eating disorder, you're using a lot of the same strategies.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense when you kind of break it down that way. When you look back on your undergraduate career as a dietetic student and then maybe transitioning into graduate school, can you think back and remember kind of what area you had wanted to work in and had it changed a lot from those experiences, say, in grad school?
Yeah. So I remember being in undergrad, and I think it was the nutrition through the life cycle class. And we started talking about pregnancy, And then the professor puts up this slide all about iron transfer across the placenta. And I was just like, my jaw dropped. I was like, this is so freaking cool. Just totally nerded out. And honestly, that was like my sophomore year. It might've been my freshman year. Kind of just kept coming back to how cool I thought pregnancy was and kind of became more of a feminist. I grew up in a really conservative Christian household, and just going to college kind of became more liberal and became more interested in women's rights and feminism, and discovered how kind of broken our maternal health system is in the United States, and how high our maternal mortality rate is really unacceptable for a first world country, and kind of decided that I wanted to empower women to take their health into their own hands and feel like they had a voice in the doctor's office and in my office as well, and could really do a lot more to have better pregnancy outcomes, not just for their baby, but for themselves.
To me, that kind of caught me off guard too, when you just mentioned that the rates of everything with maternity in the US and how it's much different than you would expect. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I was even really necessarily aware of that either, because that's not my area. So how did you kind of find out about that? Was that in that nutrition class as well?
No, that didn't come up, I think, until maybe graduate school, where at Chapel Hill, there's like a maternal and child health department. Okay. So a lot of those themes kind of started to come up more in the public health classes. And there was a series published by NPR all about maternal mortality in the United States. And especially for women of color, it's like rates of third world countries. So it's like really, it's really not okay. And of course, I'm a dietitian. I'm not necessarily a nurse or a doctor. So there's only so much I can do in the heat of the moment. But what I can do is help my clients understand that they can be their own advocate for their own care, and give them a space to be listened to during their sessions with me. And I'm really passionate about that.
Yeah. And I can imagine that's really empowering that you're able to provide them with that information and help them in that way.
Thanks. Yeah. It feels good for me too. I start to get really fired up, and honestly can get caught on quite the feminist rants if I'm not careful enough in those sessions, but you know, it's all for good reason.
Yeah. Well, I think that's just a sign you're working in the right area when you have that passion in you.
Thanks. Definitely.
So shifting gears a little bit, if you don't mind, I'm also a little curious about in your personal life, if you're willing to share how maybe your relationship with food has evolved over the years, because I know for me in dietetic school, I had my own motivations for picking that area of study, mm-hmm. and some dietitians share similar backgrounds, but you know, what was that like for you over the years?
Yeah. So I grew up in a household where, food was like generally, it wasn't really demonized or anything like that for the most part. But really, it was kind of in middle school when my body started changing and I started taking ballet classes, had an adult in my life make a comment about my body and snacking, kind of continue to make a couple comments here and there. And me being a perfectionist and a rule follower just kind of latched onto that and was like, oh, I need to fix this. This is a problem. And really did struggle with some disordered eating through high school and in college as well. But it's hard for me to really pull apart where my interest in nutrition and healthy eating fully comes from. I think I decided to be a dietitian because I have always loved food and cooking and science and helping people. So I think the career path really did end up being the right one for me regardless. But it is always a tough question when I think about that. Like, would I have really become a dietitian if I didn't have this obsession with healthy eating as a teenager? Because that's like when you're making this decision. I've decided I wanted to be a dietitian when I was 17, which is so young, you know? So yeah, definitely it's an interesting thing to think about, but I do think I probably would have ended up here one way or another regardless. So I did ballet through high school, kind of had one friend at one point kind of make a comment about how she was a little worried for me and how I looked a little skinny. And me being a perfectionist, same thing, kind of like pulled myself out of it a little bit. But in that kind of, we call it like the pseudo recovery phase, where you're just kind of barely, you're just kind of getting by, flying under the radar, definitely still struggling mentally, but maybe physically you're kind of okay. And it was kind of that way through college, and was definitely an unhealthy coping skill that I leaned back on, that restriction, whenever there was something really stressful. And I did go through a lot of different family issues, from like my dad losing his job and some other drama that happened back home that I felt like I couldn't control because I was so far away. I was all the way on the other side of the country for college. And college was hard. Like, classes are difficult. So it definitely was a way for me to kind of not have to feel my feelings. And I didn't realize that until later when I actually sought therapy. So my journey to intuitive eating really started, well, I'll say I heard about Health at Every Size my senior year of college, second semester, at the very end of our medical nutrition therapy curriculum. My professor just kind of throws it out there. And I was like, what is this BS? This goes against literally everything I was just taught for 4 years. Like, what?
Yeah.
And just kind of like, yeah, just kind of like discredited it. Was like, I don't believe in this. But then fast forward to this summer before grad school, made a really, really good friend who was working the same research job as me, was in my cohort in grad school, brought up intuitive eating and introduced me to food psych podcasts. And honestly, it really did not take me much time to jump totally on board. It just made a lot of sense. It made a lot of sense based on my experience. Kind of this, I guess, this social justice streak that I had really got fired up too. So yeah, I listened to that and I was a little skeptical at first, but once I read the 2011 Weight Science Paradigm Shift paper by Linda Bacon and Lucy Aframore, I was like, all right, there's my science. That's what I needed.
Mm-hmm. On board. Such a good paper.
Yeah. And so from there, I did a lot of work with intuitive eating on my own, stopped weighing myself and really kind of pushed myself to challenge myself, and just kind of got to a point where I was like, I am still clearly using this as a coping skill and I need help. I need somebody else to help me. And so that's when I started going to therapy. Turns out that food is not actually the issue. That I actually have anxiety and perfectionism. And I've had a lot of the hard things happen in my life that I needed to talk to somebody about so I could actually deal with. And that's kind of where that true healing was able to take place. And since then, I can call myself very confidently a very intuitive eater. Mm-hmm. But it's really something that I didn't realize. I went to therapy thinking I needed to have this perfect relationship with food, now that was my new perfect ideal, right? But in reality, there were deeper mental health issues that I just had no idea I needed to deal with so that my relationship with food could be better. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at today.
Yeah, well, and I think you bring up such a good point is, a lot of times we want to villainize the food and it's all about the food. And, you know, I've had clients come to me and, you know, just want to know what to eat or just want to talk about the food. But what we realize through sessions and what I hear from other people, much like your story, it is so much deeper than just the food. There's things beneath that. And food is almost like it's showing itself as a symptom of what's going on and whatever way it's, you know, manifesting itself with eating or restricting or whatever the case may be. But more often than not, something else is going on that's causing that to happen.
Yes, 100%. I see the same thing with my clients as well. It's really awesome to kind of have that chance to open our clients' eyes and be like, hey, I think, like, yes, I'm here as your dietitian to talk about the food. That is my job title. But really this, like, if we're looking at your holistic health, it seems like these eating issues are not you being out of control, are not you lacking willpower. It sounds like maybe there's an underlying thing you're trying to deal with, and your coping mechanism really makes sense in context. Maybe it's not the healthiest coping mechanism for you to deal. We can acknowledge that you've done really hard work to try and deal with this when you didn't have the right tools in your toolbox. So let's talk about some different tools that you can use and nourishing your body properly so that you can do the work in therapy that you need to do to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, I'd heard of Health at Every Size. One of my classmates, I think my senior year of college, so this would have been back in 2014, she had just asked about health at every size. I think she had read about it somewhere, and it just kind of was asked in class. And I don't know that my professor was familiar with health at every size, so there wasn't a lot of discussion on it. And then I started out more with learning about intuitive eating from one of my grad school classmates. And then, you know, a couple years later, then I started to actually really start to implement it. So it took some time. But, you know, that isn't something we learn about in school. And I think for me, when I read about intuitive eating, and I love reading the book. It's an easy read because it's so relatable. And it almost took this weight off my shoulders, because for so long I thought, oh my gosh, I'm the only one who's out of control with food. And I have so much shame as a future dietitian because I can't control my food. And that's what we always talk about, is control. And it was such a relief in a sense. And I think clients relate to that when they also read about intuitive eating or work with a practitioner.
Totally. I think it just makes a lot of sense. It's countercultural. It's a radical approach, mm-hmm. but it's one that, I mean, it's intuitive. There's really not a better word for it. It just makes sense according to human nature.
And it's almost funny that we have to call it radical, because, you know, one of the principles is honor your hunger. It's crazy that that has to be a radical thing, that diet culture has gotten so bad that we're not listening to something so basic as our hunger.
Exactly. And the fact that one of the main points of the book is, in the beginning, like, we all start out as intuitive eaters, and then we get these messages from society that certain foods are good, certain foods are bad, and you need to be careful with your hunger because you can't trust yourself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But naturally, we are born all as intuitive eaters. We really can tune into that natural instinct. And yeah, I'm excited for the day when intuitive eating is no longer radical.
I hope it's sooner rather than later.
I know. I feel like it's getting there.
I think so too. Even though we're seeing where some of the messaging of intuitive eating gets hijacked by diet culture, the fact that people are seeing that this is an important message and they're trying to steal it for their own cause makes me feel like, yeah, I mean, at least it's getting out there, and hopefully the correct information will eventually come with it when people dig hard enough.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of like I'm forgetting what the phrase is, but like, if somebody copies you, like, maybe we should look at it as flattery, and maybe it's not correct to co-opt and to plagiarize.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, it is a little flattering.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's showing at least that, I don't know if it's that diets are, or that industry is feeling threatened, that they're like, oh, well, this is working for people. Let's try to finagle that in there somehow.
Yes, yes.
So I'm in the middle of an intuitive eating series, and you're actually the first guest, and I'm so excited to chat with you about principle 3, make peace with food. And part of the reason I wanted to do a series on the 10 principles of intuitive eating is I think it's really the foundation of a lot of topics that I can hopefully get to on this podcast, but I wanted to give the opportunities for listeners to at least hear some sound bites about what intuitive eating is about in each of those principles. And then hopefully they might feel more curious to pick up a book, or if they're able to work with a practitioner. So when you hear make peace with food or a peaceful relationship with food, how might you describe that, or what comes to mind?
Yeah. So to me, a peaceful relationship with food looks like trusting that your body will make the right decisions, or that you can make the right decisions according to your body cues when it comes to food, eating, nutrition, and movement. And I guess we're talking more about the food piece here, but I think movement is totally part of that. Like, feeling like you won't have to compensate because you trust what your body is doing, and you trust that it will function when you feed it, just period, and that you will feed it well according to those cues. So that involves, it's kind of building off of the honoring your hunger and trusting that your fullness will guide you as well, knowing that different foods don't have moral value, and that every single food that you could possibly eat will provide you with something. It will give you some sort of nourishment. You will need all of those different types of foods in order to live a fulfilling, well-nourished, holistically healthy life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this one, you know, when I say peaceful relationship with food, it encompasses all of intuitive eating. So while we're talking about it in principle 3, you know, you brought up how movement can come into that too. And sometimes it's almost difficult to kind of suss out between the principles, because a lot of them really do overlap. And it's kind of like, oh, this one's pretty similar to the last one. And, you know, there's some little differences that come along with it, but overall, they're all intertwined and interdependent.
Totally. And in one session with a client, we might work on three of the three different principles all at the same time. And it's good to kind of have the book structured in the way where you can kind of go back and see what these different concepts really mean. It can be a really fluid process. It's not like you have to accomplish step one before moving on to step two.
I think principle three is one of those principles too. If you are going in order, you know, principle two is honoring the hunger, and then we get to make peace with food in principle three. This one I think can be really intimidating for people because the authors in the book use the phrase unconditional permission to eat. And I know for me, when I was first learning about intuitive eating, I was like, there's no way I will eat everything in sight. So is that something you notice with people? Did you experience that yourself? Or what do you think that fear is around that unconditional permission to eat?
I think our society has just given us so many messages that we don't deserve certain types of food, traditionally labeled as quote unquote junk food, if we are not moving a certain amount, or if we did not eat the other quote unquote healthy foods for the day, or maybe we don't have enough points if you're on the Weight Watchers system. There's just a lot of conditions. So you might almost think about it like unconditional love, like a mother is supposed to love her child unconditionally no matter what. And that's how we can treat our bodies as well. And that's how we can treat our relationship with food, that no matter what, you do always deserve to have pleasurable, nourishing foods all of the time.
And I think it's so important to realize that. I think when people hear that unconditional permission to eat, they automatically, it's like they clench up and they're like, oh, I can't do that. I have to have these set rules that, you know, Weight Watchers or whatever they rebranded it to as WW, or gosh, what are some other ones? You mentioned listening to Christy Harrison. I'm a huge fan of Christy Harrison, and she talks about kind of like our wellness culture we have now, where it's not as sexy to call something a diet. So now we have all of this, you know, like the Whole30.
Yeah, like the eating, like clean eating and the whole foods diet. Even if you're not doing Whole30, you might be like, I want to eat only whole foods or whatever.
Yeah. And so those can be really sneaky because it's almost like, oh, well, I mean, I'm not having to have this slim fast shake or things like that. Like, yeah, I do have a lot of freedom amongst those foods. But at the same time, like, they're demonizing foods. Like, sugar is a huge one that I think I wish we could get rid of this fear of sugar sometime soon.
My favorite concept to talk about is just basic carbohydrate metabolism and just kind of drawing that super basic diagram of like the apple going in the person's mouth and how it breaks down. And then we could replace that apple with a cupcake, with a donut, with a lollipop. It doesn't matter. It's all going to turn into glucose. And just the fact that it's so normalized too, like we get messages from the CDC and the WHO about limiting your added sugar. It just really doesn't send the right messages about how we can nourish our bodies with all different types of foods and how we don't have to feel guilt or feel anxiety that we're doing some harm to our bodies when we do eat these foods, because the purpose is providing carbohydrates for our bodies to have fuel and to give us a little energy boost if we need it and to provide pleasure. And those are all valid purposes that don't need to be compensated for.
And something I think that's so paramount to the make peace with food principle is that what we find is when people do eliminate sugar, which is so the trend right now, often what happens is, at least what I've noticed, is once you are telling yourself you have to eliminate that, it's like, that's all you can think about now because you've demonized it or villainized that food.
Exactly. That food kind of gets put on this high pedestal or like on this high shelf and just becomes more and more and more sparkly. You want it more and more and more until all of a sudden you just can't take it anymore. You give in and you eat a lot more than you were intending in the first place. My qualms with the all the messaging out there about limiting sugar is that it's not effective. And in fact, it's going to do the exact opposite of what the intention is in the first place.
And I think too, part of the, you know, we put so much power in, you know, I think the big headline a couple of years ago, and people still try to bring this into discussion about sugar, is that they were comparing it to lighting up the same chemical receptors in our brain as cocaine. And hence the conclusion they were drawing was that it's as addictive as cocaine. I'm sure you remember when this was the big trend as well.
Yes.
What are you seeing with that type of information? Is that something you hear people complain about a lot or say, but it's addictive? Like, I can't have this. It's an all or nothing thing, much like other substances you can be addicted to. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, okay. First of all, there's so many different things that light up the pleasure center in your brain. We could talk about laughter, puppies, music.
Hug, like a simple hug.
Does that mean we're addicted to those things too? So it's just a really, it's terrible science, one. So that's really frustrating. But also it kind of totally discounts the, like, what real addictions actually are and what they actually look like. Having people in my life that have suffered from addictions, it's kind of honestly makes me a little angry. And it's really not the same thing. It's not that your pain is not valid and that you feel like out of control with this food, but it is not the same thing at all. In true addiction, somebody's going to go through withdrawals. They're going to need really intense rehab, a totally different model. Whereas the fix to feeling out of control with food is actually adding more of that food in and kind of habituating to it. So in that sense, like, we really can't call it an addiction at all.
And I think too, like we were talking about, we're putting so much power to the food when in reality, it's more that diet and the restriction and the limitation of those foods that's causing us to behave in that way or to, you know, I think it's valid to say we may feel like we're addicted to food, but I don't know that it's necessarily a real addiction, as we just talked about, right?
Exactly.
There's a difference between feeling like, oh my goodness, I'm really craving that, and being truly addicted.
Totally. Yeah. And like I said, that's not to discount the way that you feel drawn to sugar or whatever food it might be, to discount the shame and the guilt you might feel after binging on said substance. Really, the problem is when providers treat it like an addiction and try to get you to abstain from it more. If restriction is really the problem, then more restriction is worsening the problem and causing you to go deeper into disordered eating. And so that's why looking at it as an addiction and using an addiction model of treatment for somebody who has binge eating disorder or feels out of control with certain foods, that's why it's so harmful. And that's why thinking about it as an addiction is really not okay.
You mentioned how incorporating foods into your daily routine. So maybe I am very fearful, we'll kind of shift gears with maybe potato chips or something. And if I just feel that I cannot have a bag of potato chips in the house without just going crazy and eating the whole thing. And so you mentioned habituation. So how might that look for a client in practice?
Oh my gosh, I'm literally working. I had a session with a client this morning and we're actually working on chips. So this is funny.
Oh, so this is timely.
So this client in particular, she has a very stressful job. She gets kind of like, she'll get stressful emails and kind of have this need to have this tactile stimulus in order to kind of deal with her stress in the moment, and really just goes to food. That's like the first thing that she goes to. Previously, this wasn't an issue for her because she had maybe like, or it wasn't an issue during the day because she would have her pre-portioned meals. She didn't have snacks. Now we've got snacks incorporated, which is awesome. So she feels less hungry. And so the binging for her would happen maybe at the end of the day when honestly, she's just really hungry. And then also has been thinking about these potato chips that have been sitting in the cabinet. Oh, I shouldn't have them. I shouldn't have them. I shouldn't have them. And gets home, eats a bunch of them, feels bad about herself, and then eats less at dinner. And kind of the cycle just keeps continuing. So for her and for a lot of my clients, it's this combination of primal hunger. Like, you haven't eaten enough in the day. And so you get to, and you're also thinking so much about this food that your sense of need for this food is just really, really heightened. What I've been working on with her, we worked on the hunger first and intentionally incorporating snacks throughout the day. And that honestly pretty much took care of the get home from work binge while it was happening, from what she's reported to me. And we were continuing to work on other aspects of intuitive eating as well. And then all of a sudden, now she's having to stay home. The chips are around. She has access to them. And so her response to stress then, so more of a, like an emotional response, was to go grab something. She just had a lot of fear that she was just going to only be eating all of these snacks, when in reality, she's actually feeding herself a whole wide variety of foods. So kind of like pointing out like, hey, no, you're actually doing a really good job. Like, you're not feeding yourself crap all the time. You have fun foods when you want fun foods. You have basic staple foods and fruits and vegetables and protein and whole grains and all that kind of stuff too. And maybe you're kind of viewing this food, and we talked about that metaphor of it being kind of this sparkly thing on the high shelf that you just really want, and it's really forbidden. So I challenged her 2 weeks ago. I was like, why don't you go to the grocery store, get some chips, and let's see what happens. She was like, are you kidding? And she was like really nervous about that. And I kind of talked about like what habituation might look like and how really she can trust herself. She's like, okay, we'll see how this goes. So first she tried out brownies. That went fine. She's like, okay. And she's more of a savory person than a sweet person. So the brownies, she didn't feel out of control around. And then she went back to the store. She went to the chip aisle. She's like, okay, my homework is to buy chips. And then she found herself honestly not even wanting chips anymore. I will honestly say that's like the fastest that's ever happened with anybody. So a lot of people need a little bit more of the work. So her homework this week, and she ended up buying some veggie chips as kind of like an in-between, and maybe was going to be more challenging chips later, ended up hating the veggie chips and hasn't touched them. Yeah, so now her homework this week is to go buy the actual chips. So that was a really awesome realization that she had in our session, was like, oh, it wasn't forbidden anymore. Maybe that's why I like had such a hard time choosing, because I just like didn't really want it that much. And so we still are working through some other thoughts and beliefs that she has about chips and what that means, what it would mean to have them as a more regular part of her day, and how she could intentionally incorporate them into snacks to kind of continue building on that habituation. That was a really awesome realization for her to make, that already just that one little thought reframe of this isn't forbidden anymore. And already she was noticing that she had a way decreased desire to have the chips on hand.
And that's so empowering too, because especially when you go into it very skeptical and you have almost this assumption that you're going to go crazy on the chips or whatever that food that you feel like holds a lot of power over you. And then to have an experience like that and you're like, oh, wait, it's not that I'm going crazy over chips. It's just that it was forbidden. And it kind of teaches you that quick lesson. And it's really empowering, especially when it happens so quick, like it did for your client.
Yeah, exactly. And I will say that is a rare occurrence for those listening, that it very often takes a little bit more time to feel at peace. A lot of times there might be kind of more of a honeymoon phase where you just all of a sudden you're like, yeah, now I can have literally everything ever. I can have tortilla chips and Pirate's Booty and Cheetos and Cheez-Its like all at the same time. And that's going to happen. And you know what? That's okay. If that's what needs to happen for you to have a better relationship with food, to make up for all of those years of restriction, there is no shame in that. And eventually your body will adjust, your mind will adjust, and you'll feel a lot better about that. But the idea of having a honeymoon phase and feeling totally out of control in that sense can be really, really scary. And for my clients who push through that, they're just so incredibly brave. And it really does take a lot of work to not feel shame around that. So I really enjoy validating what those foods are providing for that client. Having a little bit of an FU moment with diet culture during that process too can be really fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you bring up that really good point about the honeymoon phase. I like the phrasing of that, because this probably is a little atypical to have something, you know, a turnover that quickly with that relationship with something like potato chips. Whereas sometimes, and there's no shame in it, like you mentioned, of having those moments where, okay, I did feel like I was out of control, or I binged on all these different foods. And sometimes it's almost like, I don't know if this would be the right way to put it, but it's like we have to get it out of their system on this on this journey. And then we start to incorporate it maybe in a more structured way, like with potato chips at lunch every day. And then maybe eventually we do get to that point where it's like, I don't know, potato chips don't even sound good today. Let's have, you know, celery with it, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. It could be something completely different.
Yeah, totally. And I like that. I like the idea of intentionally incorporating those foods, really saying, no, really, this is a valid part of your meal. This has nutritional value. Potato chips provide carbs and fat, and you need those things. You really do need them. Like the idea that something is quote unquote empty calories is just complete BS. I really have a lot of fun working through that with clients and helping them see how it can be part of a balanced eating pattern where meals have carbs, protein, fat, fiber, flavor, and chips fill three of those things, carbs, fat, and flavor, which is really cool, can really help boost that confidence that the client has in feeling like a competent eater.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, it kind of leads into some of the other principles, like feeling your fullness or the satisfaction factor too. Cause it's like, I mean, I could fill myself up on celery sticks, for example, but it may, if I'm craving chips or I really enjoy chips, it's not going to have the same satisfaction factor. No. So let's get a good variety of all these different nutrients. I think so many people think we just leave nutrition out of the equation. No, we're talking about the nutritional value of these things, mm-hmm. but so much more has to go into play with our relationship with food before we can dive deeper into the nutrition component.
We could even talk about the fact that celery doesn't have carbs. And if you're not going to eat enough carbs at that meal, you're not going to have the energy that you need to get through the rest of the day. So if your brain is thinking, I think I want potato chips, it might be a sign that you need a little bit more carb to get through the rest of the afternoon or the evening or whatever. And celery is really not going to provide that for you. Celery will have its time and its place, maybe even at the same meal. Maybe you have celery and potato chips. You don't necessarily have to choose one or the other, but maybe celery will have its time and its place at a different meal or a different snack where you have adequate carbohydrates and maybe it just sounds cool and refreshing.
What are, you know, before we wrap up, what are some other things that maybe come to mind with this principle that we haven't covered that you think would be important for listeners to know about this principle of making peace with food?
Yeah, I think maybe something we haven't totally touched on is how food doesn't have moral value. There are no good foods. There are no bad foods. It's just food. Every food is going to provide something for your body in each moment of your life. I'm currently finishing up Anti-Diet by Christy Harrison. We're just like fangirling her hardcore right now. But
I know.
One of the examples she gives is of choosing like the choice between an apple and a hamburger. The apple might provide something cool and refreshing, a little bit of carbohydrate to get you through something a short while, or maybe an accompaniment to a meal. And the hamburger is going to provide a lot more sustaining energy and protein and carbs that you might need more at like a mealtime. When you are craving something sweet and cool and refreshing, a hamburger is not going to fulfill that need. Or maybe you're not hungry enough for a hamburger and that's just like, it's just not going to fit with what you are wanting and needing in that moment. But the same goes for the other way. Like if you really want a hamburger, you really need something like a hamburger to get you through the amount of hunger that you're feeling, or maybe you're practicing planned hunger and you know you're going to have some energy that's actually sustaining for a couple more hours. The apple really is not going to be a good choice for you in that moment because it's not going to fulfill the need. The idea that no one food is good or bad is really, really important to this principle.
Yeah, and they can all serve a purpose. And like you mentioned, when you're breaking down potato chips, it's like they have carbs, they have fats in them. You know, it's not like when we hear such the big word is like they're full of chemicals and it's fake food and blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. And I'm just cringing because I'm like, it's not. I mean, it has nutritional value. Like, it's not. Maybe exactly. It didn't grow straight from the ground and is spinach or something, but it's still technically food.
Oh my God. I mean, literally everything is processed. If you like pick a strawberry, that is processing. Mm-hmm. And this was another point I actually made with the same client who was worried about some of the chemicals that might be in some of the things that she was craving. When you look at what might be a toxic level of something, sure, like maybe Red 40 or whatever might be toxic if you were to drink like a gallon of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But nobody drinks a gallon of straight Red 40. That's just not, it's not humanly possible. It really isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a perfect way to wrap things up. Thank you so much for coming on today. Before we go, I want to make sure that you have a chance to tell listeners, what are some, you know, do you have any cool projects you're working on? Also, where can they find you on Instagram or Facebook or wherever you're hanging out? After hearing this, I know they're going to want to seek you out.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Amanda. I think this series is going to be really awesome, and I can't wait to listen to all of it later. So you can find me at www.feedyourzest.com on Instagram and then Facebook and Twitter too, but mostly Instagram as at feedyourzest. And then I am taking new one-on-one clients now, currently totally virtual because of the pandemic, but really excited to get back into in-person. In addition to virtual clients as well, once all of the stay-at-home orders are lifted. And then on top of that, I have a course for dietetic students and interns, really any dietitian too, who's really interested in diving deep into how to apply health at every size and intuitive eating. So our online course is called Nourish Your Knowledge, and it recently got approved for 3.5 CEUs. So you can find that at nourish-your-knowledge.teachable.com. And then we do have a Facebook group. And if it's easier for you to just go to our Instagram page too, at Nourish Your Knowledge is the Instagram for that. And you can click around in the links and all that kind of stuff. But it's really an awesome way for anybody who's just kind of overwhelmed with the idea of health at every size and intuitive eating, feeling really convicted that you want to dive in and learn how to apply these things, where we have lectures on how to apply these principles in all different areas of dietetics, and then options to add on some group supervision as well to dive into discussion about it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, and I appreciate taking time out of your busy day.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me.
That's our show for today. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you to Anchor for again hosting my podcast. Be sure to download and subscribe this podcast on Apple or your favorite streaming device. If you're looking for ways to get started on your own journey towards food freedom, head over to my website at spillingthebeansnutrition.com/course to get started on my self-paced course. If you need more individualized help, I also offer virtual coaching, and you can get in touch with me at spillingthebeansnutrition.com/virtual-coaching. To get show notes from this episode, you can go to spillingthebeansnutrition.com/podcast. And of course, if you're not already following me on Instagram or Facebook, I'm at spillingthebeans_nutrition. Our album art was photographed by my very own little cousin, Brittany Preller, and our theme song was written by Daniel James O'Connor and is used under the Creative Commons license.